Does metabolic surgery help cardiovascular outcomes?
When someone has a heart attack and disease in the other coronary arteries, what do you do?
If you choose one of three ways to get your varicose veins treated, which of them is the best?
And new issues regarding lung disease in people who vape.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on September 20th, 2019.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we're going to turn first to the New England Journal of Medicine. Some studies, in fact, a few of them, and reports that have been published relative to this issue of vaping. Right now, 400 cases plus of people with severe lung disease secondary to the use of these devices and the products.
And these four reports provide the first cluster of cases reported, 53 cases reported in Wisconsin and Illinois, and then case reports of six cases in Utah, and then some issues regarding what one finds on chest x-ray and also when one does bronchoscopy as well. And as you said, there have been several hundred cases reported spanning at least 25 states in the District of Columbia, and they've occurred within the last several months. From Wisconsin and the Illinois Department of Public Health, they give us some insight into the clinical characteristics. They report 53 patients, most of whom were male, 83%. The interesting thing is the median age of the patients was 19 years old. And that should tell you these are people that don't have any underlying medical conditions. And by the way, a third of those were under the age of 17. The vast majority of them have respiratory symptoms, breathing difficulty. But about 81% have gastrointestinal symptoms, such as nausea and vomiting and diarrhea. The vast majority were hospitalized. About a third of them ended up being intubated. 84% of the patients reported having vaped tetrahydrocannabinol products in their e-cigarette devices. What things do we need to recognize? We need to recognize it's a serious condition. Most of these people present within several days to weeks, but some as much as 2 months after the vaping episode. When someone presents with this, especially a youngster with respiratory symptoms, we need to ask about whether they've been vaping or not. And obviously, the recommendation we'd give is that we not vape.
I've been seeing a lot of speculation relative to what is it in this product that's causing such a problem. And the latest thing I saw was something that was a vitamin E analog. When you referred to the bronchoscopy, what did they show there?
When you look at the different patterns, there's not a single pattern. There seems to be heterogeneous manifestations. Some of these individuals have macrophages. These are white cells that eat things that have a lot of lipids in them. And usually you don't get that unless someone's been ingesting some sort of a lipid and has aspirated it. It's not in every single patient. And there are a number of different things in the vaping material that can cause it. So right now, the FDA and other organizations are looking at the individual components of the specific vaping products that have known to have been causes. But even again, there's not a single vaping product that's unique to all of these individuals.
I just wonder why it's emerged so suddenly as such a problem.
That's a great question. Another thing that's happened is the use among adolescents has just about doubled over the last several years. These things aren't regulated, so I'm sure there are adulterants or other toxic chemicals in there that we're not even aware of yet.
An emerging story. I'm sure we're going to be talking about it again. Let's turn from here to the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is from the European Society of Cardiology meeting, and this is taking a look at bariatric, or so-called, now we're morphing it into metabolic surgery, and cardiovascular outcomes in people with type 2 diabetes and obviously obesity. They took a look at 287,000 plus adult patients with diabetes as part of the Cleveland Clinic Health System in the U.S. between 1998 and 2017. And of that number, 2,200 plus underwent this metabolic surgery. This is a retrospective study, and of course, that's one of its limitations. They matched all these patients 1 to 5 with non-surgical patients who also had diabetes and obesity. They looked at all-cause mortality. That occurred in 112 patients in the metabolic surgery group and 1,111 patients in the non-surgical group. So it actually reduced the overall mortality from 17.8% in the non-surgical group to about 10% in the group who did have surgery. What the editorialist pointed out, that the control group was slightly older, about 2 years older than the intervention group. They also had higher diastolic blood pressures and a lot more missing data. So they call into question whether this is really an effective comparator group. And they also identify a factor that we've talked about before for people who undergo bariatric or metabolic surgery, and that's that these folks are really motivated. They have to have a really extensive preoperative evaluation and agree to all kinds of things secondary to the surgery, both before and afterward. And so the fact that their mortality was reduced may have been due to all the rest of this rather than the actual intervention.
You're right. This is an observational study. People weren't randomized to metabolic surgery or no metabolic surgery. And as you alluded to, those that had the surgery had a reduction in all-cause mortality and in other, what we call, major cardiovascular outcomes, things like cerebrovascular events and heart failure and coronary artery events. And the surgery looked like it was better in all of those, but it needs to be confirmed in a randomized control. So I agree with you. A little caution, this kind of teases us that in fact the metabolic surgery may be beneficial with regard to heart outcomes, but we need to tease this out better in a randomized trial.
Why don't we turn to another one that I thought was very noteworthy? And this was the idea that, gosh, when you revascularize, when you replace vessels in someone's heart, maybe you ought to be doing all of them, even though you think you only need to do one. That's also in the New England Journal.
This is pertinent to about a half the patients that have a heart attack that is called an ST elevation myocardial infarction. That's when a clot closes off a large artery and there's a portion of the heart that's getting insufficient blood flow. And we treat that by opening that artery up, either by giving a drug or more commonly using a stent. And when we take those pictures, oftentimes it's not only that one blockage, but there are other significant blockages in other vessels. And the question is, do you open those up also, or do you just address the one vessel causing the heart attack? So to answer that question, this is a randomized trial, and they randomized them once they determined they had multivessel disease. And after they had a successful opening of their artery that caused the heart attack, within the next 72 hours, they randomized them to just medical therapy or also opening the other blood vessels up. And that could either be done during the hospitalization or any time over the next 7 weeks. Patients that had complete revascularization had a decreased incidence of the combination of death and subsequent heart attack. By the way, mainly driven by about a 30% decrease in heart attack followed over the course of 3 years. I want to remind our listeners that these are people that had their initial heart attack artery opened up successfully. The film suggested that the operator, the cardiologist, could open up the other vessels. They didn't have other significant comorbidities or heart disease.
And I'm just wondering about the pathology there, and if that's not something that's more generalized, even though it may not result in an occlusion that necessitates the placement of a stent immediately.
That's a good point. These individuals already are predisposed to having a heart attack because they've had one. A vulnerable plaque or a vulnerable blockage has caused a clot to form, and perhaps the other vessels in that same individual are predisposed to that as well. So opening them up, putting a stent in, can minimize that. Now, after the patients got treated, obviously they were also put on medical therapy as well. So the combination of medical therapy and revascularizing this particular group of individuals, but it decreased the risk of having a subsequent heart attack over the next 3 years.
Okay, let's complete our look this week in the New England Journal of Medicine at a study that took a look at three different methods for treating varicose veins and what were the 5-year outcomes secondary to that. This study was done in almost 800 participants with primary varicose veins at 11 centers in the UK, and they compared the outcomes of laser ablation, foam sclerotherapy, and surgery. These primary outcomes at 5 years were disease-specific quality of life and generic quality of life, as well as cost effectiveness based on models of expected costs and qualies. We can't get away from those qualies. They also used patients' treatment costs and scores on a questionnaire. They got 75% of these folks who were enrolled in the trial to actually complete all of that. There was a better quality of life among patients who underwent laser ablation or surgery versus the foam sclerotherapy. They also found that this, how many dollars, like how cost effective was it? This basically favored laser ablation as the best way to treat it.
This is one of those studies that's kind of interesting because it's both quality of life and cost benefit. The foam sclerotherapy happens to be the least expensive of the therapies. It's about $500 less than the laser therapy and about $1,000 less than the surgery. But when you factor in what the quality of life benefits are, in essence, if you say, I think it's worth $30,000 to have a better quality of life, then what happens is the laser therapy certainly does the best of all three. So it's a combination of looking at the two. And why is that better? Because the laser therapy, you're less likely to have a recurrence of your varicose those veins than you are with either surgery or with foam, with sclerotherapy. Even though it's a little bit more expensive, this is looking at the cost-benefit analysis.
One of the things that they didn't talk about in the study, and I know they have the quality-adjusted life years, and they did assess patient factors, but they didn't really talk about the procedures themselves and how challenging or not challenging they are for people to undergo.
The surgery obviously requires surgical expertise. Many times the laser therapy and the foam sclerotherapy may be done by a non-surgical specialist. The surgery requires general anesthesia. The other two therapies require local anesthesia the vast majority of time, about 90% of the time. The surgery is typically done, obviously, in a surgical center, which may be an ambulatory or an inpatient setting. The others can be done more of an outpatient setting. The nice thing is that in most major metropolitan areas, you have any of those three techniques available. But I agree with you. The value of the study is, well, you have all three. Which one has the most durable outcome? Which one gives you a better quality of life? And over the long term, which one is more or less cost effective? So this is a terrific study.
And I think they're going to follow it up longer, too.
Yeah, so they initially reported on the six-month outcomes, and this is the five-year outcome. And by the way, I'm glad that you picked this one, because I've always wondered which is better, because the patients come in and ask me, they say, well, you know, we really don't have a long-term outcome in a randomized trial, but we do now.
On that note, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.